We're going to continue our discussion about health insurance. I have two guests. Art Kaplan is the chair of the Medical Ethics Department at the University of Pennsylvania. Sherry Gleed is the chair of the Department of Health Policy and Management at Columbia University's School of Public Health. We just heard from Chris Butler of Independence Blue Cross in Pennsylvania that although Blue Cross in southeastern Pennsylvania supports a community rating system, they feel compelled to switch to a demographic rating system so that other companies don't cherry-pick the healthy young consumers. Is that a trend that we're seeing nationally?
Absolutely. Even in the new Medicare bill, it's pretty clear that the incentives are there for large for-profit companies to hunt down the healthiest of the elderly, sell them insurance, and leave the sicker, the chronically ill, to public programs. If you can run your health maintenance organization by avoiding the sick, or at least those at high risk of illness, you're going to make a lot more money.
Are either of you concerned that this is going to end up in employment discrimination, that younger, healthier people will be hired more quickly than older people or people with medical problems just to save money on the benefits package?
We're not seeing that very much to date. There's really been a concern about that for a long time, but there's actually relatively little evidence of it, and I think in some ways that's surprising. There certainly is an incentive for employers to do that. We just haven't seen them do it very much today.
What bothers me about this is I think that it hasn't really been worthwhile to try and weed out people aggressively in the employment setting to try and discourage them from having a job at a particular company because they're more likely to be sick. But if you put in the mix this explosion of new information from genetic testing and you start to be able to say, he's likely to get diabetes, she's likely to be depressed, there I think you could finally get, if you will, enough information going so that companies would start to say, well, then we're not going to hire X, Y, and Z because they're going to cost us too much.
One of the trends in health insurance now is that as costs are going up, companies are cutting back on their medical benefit packages and offering less good packages, and they're also charging their employees a greater percentage of the cost. So a lot of employees are understandably really angry, both with their companies and with the medical insurers that are pricing more. From your points of view, I'm wondering if this is just a kind of like fact of life that you think employees have to deal with because, you know, expenses are going up and, you know, somebody's got to pay for it, or whether you think that, something needs to be changed in the equation.
I think it probably is essentially a fact of life. I mean, I think the rising cost of healthcare has to be paid by somebody, and it's going to be split in some ways between employers and employees in terms of who actually sees the cost in the bottom line. But in the end, I think economists pretty much agree that employees wind up paying the full bill one way or another. I think the thing that's a little worrisome is that as the employee costs go up, there's kind of more opportunity for people in the workplace to drop out of coverage, more potential for that to happen. And I think that's kind of a dangerous trend.
Well, I think the little businesses are getting overwhelmed. There's no doubt that somebody's got to pay the freight. And so that's going to fall on the employer's plate. That's how we do health insurance in the United States for a lot of people. And if the costs keep going up, and they do, some of the small businesses just say, we can't play in the system. So they begin to pull the benefit back completely. Others start to offer some pretty scanty packages of care. Where I think this goes, though, is it makes us ask a key ethical question, and that is, if we're going to saddle business with the cost of health care, is that the right way to do this? And I'm starting to think that isn't the right way to do this. No other country in the world seems to make health care conditional on employment.
I mean, no, but in Germany, for example, most of health insurance still runs through jobs, and there are actually quite a number of other countries where health insurance is pretty closely tied to employment.
But they're still even taxing those who are employed for the unemployed, so to speak. There's nobody running around Germany or Holland or any of those countries, any of the modern developed countries of the world, including, I might add, South Africa, who falls out of the system when they lose their job.
And that's absolutely, I agree.
That's something we just haven't fixed. We have to figure out a better financing scheme than saying, well, no matter what size the business, if you're 3 employees or 3,000 employees, you've got to pick up the freight. The way costs are exploding, it just doesn't make any sense to go that way unless we can somehow share out the costs in a more systematic way among all businesses.
Well, you know, health insurance is now called a benefit. It is a benefit if you work. Sherry Glee, do you think that health insurance should be a right or a benefit of working?
I'm not very comfortable with the language of rights just because I'm an economist and I'm not really sure exactly what those mean in practical terms. I do think that everybody in our country ought to have some form of health insurance. I don't think that's completely antithetical to it being a benefit of working for those people who are working and can get it in that way. But I do think everybody else ought to have a means of getting it as well. And the public system is going to have to step in for many of those people.
It's the case that you can't drive around on the American highways without automobile insurance. And while there's certainly people out there who don't buy it, the rest of us pay a kind of an additional premium to cover them. So we have this situation where our automobiles are in better shape than us. It seems to me that healthcare is a right. Why is it a right? Well, it's hard to generate it from an economic point of view because in some sense you're saying, is it worth it or do the consequences matter? From my point of view, healthcare ought to be a right for two reasons. If we are going to guarantee equality of opportunity to every American, then health is a key part of that equal opportunity. You have to have it in order to function in a market-based capitalist society. The other reason is it's a sign of communal solidarity. We care about one another. We're not going to let our kids or our mentally ill or our elderly just flounder around, even if they can't, so to speak, earn it. So it seems to me society has a stake here in guaranteeing access to a minimal package of health care. The way to do it then becomes the fight. But we ought to commit once and for all, I think, philosophically to saying, yep, it's right, and everybody ought to have it. Then we can at least sit down at the bargaining table and say, if your plan doesn't cover everybody, not a good enough plan.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. We're talking about health insurance, the rising costs for the people who have it, and the growing number of the people who are uninsured. My guests are Art Kaplan, chair of the Medical Ethics Department at the University of Pennsylvania, and Sherry Gleed, chair of the Department of Health Policy and Management at Columbia University's School of Public Health. Now, Art Kaplan, you seem to be interested in moving more in the direction of a national health insurance, mm-hmm. a universal health insurance mm-hmm. in the United States. Is there a model that you could look at internationally that you could say, this is something we should seriously be considering?
Well, I'm a fan of universal access. I'm not a believer, having lived through the Clinton health care reform, that you're going to do this by single-payer, government-run insurance. Although, I have to say, ironically, one of the systems that seems to work just dandy is the Veterans Administration system, which I have to point out is about a third bigger than the British National Health Service. The government runs a gigantic government-sponsored healthcare program, fixes prices, sets limits on what you can get, and its staunchest defenders are the free marketeers of Congress who refuse to make any cuts or limit its budget in any
Absolutely.
Way. But that being said, it seems to me the goal is don't let Americans flounder in economic hard times. That's when we start to squawk about employee-based health insurance when things are going bad in the economy. Don't leave people who can't work out in the cold, those who have these chronic conditions, particularly mental illness and disabilities that just make it impossible for them to work. So it seems to me the kind of programs you want to look to are systems like either Canada or systems like France or Germany or Holland. These are combinations of employee-based and predominantly employee-based systems and then taxes that come in. I think the middle and upper class subsidy in health insurance is such a golden nugget for the haves that they really don't want to give that up. And that's one of the great, let's say, regressive public policies that have Absolutely. Put in place for a while.
Chris Butler of Independence Blue Cross of Southeastern Pennsylvania was saying, if you look at some of the national health plans in other countries, you'll see that shadow systems emerge, that people end up wanting to get coverage beyond the basics that you're given in that plan. So you have all these like other basically insurance companies that develop, and people with money buy into those companies so that they could get quicker service or better service than the basic government plan will give you. Sherry Gleed, would you agree with that perception?
Well, I think many systems operate very much and very intentionally on that premise. England does, France does, Germany has a private health insurance system. So the question is that a failing of those systems or is it a success of those systems? I think what you might say is, look, we want to have some basic level of care that everyone's entitled to, and those people who want to buy out of that, you know, go ahead and let them do that. We don't even have that basic level of health care for everyone, so I don't think that it's legitimate to complain that other people have two-tier systems when we don't even have a one-tier system for people who are really in need.
Or Kaplan?
Yeah, I think Sherry's on the right track here. It seems to me we have the same buyout, if you will. We have people these days selling boutique medicine. So if you pay an extra fee to your doctor, then your doctor will call you back or make themselves available to you. If you pay that extra amount, you can get little email messages and communications. This whole area of boutique medicine is rapidly growing within our private sector on top of, if you will, the standard benefits. So we've got some of that. All that said, the greatest enemy, I think, of getting universal health care insurance is arguments about the ceilings of health care. A lot of people say, but if the British have buyouts and the French have buyouts, that isn't fair. Everybody should be in the same boat. I think the problem is to agree on what's the minimum. Let's agree on what's in coach. Let's agree on what we're going to have in the back of the plane. Then we can argue about first class.
Well, Sherry Gleed, you're the economist in this discussion. How would you fund it?
Oh, that's a tough question. But I think one place to start looking is the way that we now subsidize employee health insurance benefits, which is really a very regressive system, because the higher your marginal tax rate, the bigger the benefit you get from health insurance. And the more health insurance you buy, the bigger the subsidy the government gives you, which is completely ridiculous. It's entirely backwards, and it ought not to be that way. So that's one place to start looking. Another place to start looking is taxes. I think that to believe that you can provide health insurance to the uninsured without paying anything for it is another pipe dream that we're just never going to get to. So I think we just have to accept the fact that it's going to cost some money and just put up and decide that we're going to pay for it. And I think it can be done incrementally. I think it can be done by singling out the people who need it most and putting your money there and then building up over time. In the expansion in the late 1990s, actually some states really did take some important steps in terms of trying to get coverage through the Medicaid program, which is in some sense a basic benefit plan, to a lot of people who didn't have it before. And I think that's the right way to keep going.
All right, Kaplan, how would you fund benefits for everybody?
I do the tax reform that Sherry's talking about. It seems to me this middle-class boondoggle that we have, upper-class boondoggle that we have, ought to be stopped. There's no excuse for subsidizing the rich to get better health care. Makes no sense at all. And then I would put in a tax. I would simply say, on your income tax, you're going to pay a certain amount of money that's going to be used as a pool to cover those who are uninsured, unemployed, or can't work. I think we've got to get small businesses pooled. That was one of the ideas in the Clinton health reform, and it still is one that has some proponents in Congress, and I think they've got to have group purchasing power together. Then I'd probably start to put in two other things to help fund healthcare access. I think we need some malpractice reform. We're spending and wasting a lot of money on that unnecessary defensive medical practice. I think it's time to probably put in some caps. I think it's time to probably agree that we're going to have mandatory arbitration on some of the malpractice things. I would like to see a no-fault error reporting system put in place so that we could weed out bad docs and weed out poor quality care. Lastly, I'd probably do away with direct-to-consumer advertising. Now, I know this is fighting words because we're talking free speech here and what you can say on TV and radio about your products, but having big companies hype their drugs. Anybody who's been watching the recent battle over erectile dysfunction, Viagra, Levitra, Cialis, can't but help thinking, my goodness, what is this costing us? And how are they going to drive prices forward for something that I wouldn't have as a core part of my medical care package?
Sherry, do you agree with that about advertising, medical advertising?
I'm not completely persuaded that medical advertising is bad. One of the things that we've worked on, for example, for many years is to try and get people to improve the recognition and treatment of depression. And I think all the evidence suggests that the massive advertising of antidepressant drugs has really raised people's awareness of depression in a way that, I mean, we might have been able to achieve if we'd put the same amount of money in public service ads, but no one was going to come up with the bill for that. Whatever the benefits or costs of direct-to-consumer advertising, as a fraction of the healthcare cost puzzle altogether, it's pretty small potatoes. It sort of hits you in the face, but it doesn't really hit you in the pocketbook.
My guests are Art Kaplan, chair of the Medical Ethics Department at the University of Pennsylvania, and Cherry Gleed, chair of the Department of Health Policy and Management at Columbia University's School of Public Health. You're both advocating some form of taxes to pay for universal health coverage. Let's be real for a moment. In the climate that we're in now, with the huge package of Bush administration tax cuts, what are the odds that taxes would be adjusted in such a way as to fund a universal health care system?
Well, my view is, if you can convince Congress and the president that we're just going to continue to lose money and it's going to cost the federal government enormous sums of money to pick up the people who fall out of the private sector, and if you could convince them that they're not giving away the keys to the kingdom by talking minimal health insurance, that we're not talking about programs that are just going to bankrupt the country eventually. Overall, you'll be – by the way, that's a crucial step, by the way, to malpractice reform as well. You don't have to worry about who's paying the costs of harm. You got everybody in the system. If you could convince them, and I think you can, that this reform would ultimately save a lot of money and protect public programs, I think you could have it happen. Is that likely to happen in the discourse we're having now? Well, I have to say, the biggest debate over the past year was prescription drug benefit for the elderly. If you were to make up a list of 1 to 10 problems that I think confront our healthcare system, I would have prescription healthcare benefit for the elderly as 11. I mean, so it's not on the agenda. There's no constituency right now for health reform. There's nobody pushing. The most powerful forces in Washington are not lobbying to get health reform done. They're lobbying to extend benefits or to keep price controls away or not to restrict free speech and consumer advertising or not to muck around with medical malpractice and liability. There isn't much of a constituency there. So will it happen? I wouldn't be betting on it.
Cherry Gleed, The Economist, do you think that there's any chance that the American people or the American government would support changes in the tax system to fund universal health coverage?
I want to be optimistic here. I think maybe the way to think about this is that we're not going to fund universal health coverage, but what we're going to try and do is expand health coverage to a few more populations. I mean, we did SCHIP during the 1990s. We did expand coverage quite a bit for kids. If we took small steps like that, eventually we'd get to where we want to go. I don't think we're about to embark on universal health coverage. We're not about to do a big program that's going to get everybody coverage. I wish we were, but we're not going to.
All right, Kaplan, I've got to ask you. You said if you were going to rate medical priorities 1 to 10, prescription drugs for the elderly would be 11.
Mm-hmm.
Why?
Because you look out there and you look at the system and you say we have no long-term care for the elderly, no real programs that still pick up solid mental health benefits, 40 million uninsured, and I could go on. But on that list, extending drug coverage to the elderly, I'm not against it, but it's just not what this system needs. We've got prices out of control, too many people still outside the system, too much waste, too much malpractice, too much hype of the latest and the newest and the best. That's a system that needs fixing in other places, and just sort of saying, well, here's this new benefit, but we're not going to watch the cost of these drugs for the elderly, and we're not going to actually do anything about the fact that the elderly can't get a nursing home, which I think is a huge problem in this system, or home care or hospice care, or that a lot of them can't even find their way to a hospice in the final days of life. That doesn't seem to me to make prescription drug benefit tops.
Cherry Gleed, what's your reaction to that?
I think, again, I agree with Art. I think that what we really see here is the political force of the elderly and their ability to, even in a Congress that doesn't want to be doling out any more money, to actually take their share. Somebody I worked with when I worked on healthcare reform suggested that instead of doing prescription drugs for the elderly, we just buy everybody a plane ticket to Florida once a year, and it would come out cheaper, and everybody would be happy. And I think as a matter of public policy, it might actually not have been a terrible idea.
You mean give them a vacation instead of a pill?
Give them a vacation. Give them a vacation instead of a pill. You know, one of the problems with this benefit is that it goes to all the elderly, not just the low-income elderly. I don't think it's unreasonable for older people to have to pay more for health care than younger people do. Healthcare is very important to older people, and they're not one of the poorest groups in our society anymore. I don't really see this as one of the most important places for us to have put public dollars right now.
Well, I think you've both taken a very unpopular,
send those cards directly to Sherry.
Right. Those letters, yeah. But you know, one of the things that I think you really see in this debate is the difference between a group like the elderly, who can coalesce around an issue that's important to them, and the group of people whom we refer to as the uninsured, as if they were as well a monolithic group of people, but in fact are an ever-changing group of people with a lot of other priorities on their mind. And I think one of the reasons that we don't see much being done for people who are uninsured is that people who are uninsured themselves are not going to be the ones out there marching on Capitol Hill trying to get legislation passed to help them. So, you know, they're an inherently politically weak group. Especially because they're ever-changing. It's not the same people from one day to the next. It's really going to take an effort of generosity, not just of self-interest, to get coverage for the uninsured.
If you're just joining us, we're talking about health insurance. I have two guests. Art Kaplan is the chair of the Medical Ethics Department at the University of Pennsylvania. Sherry Gleed is chair of the Department of Health Policy and Management at Columbia's School of Public Health. Sherry Gleed, what are some of the other reasons why you think health care costs have been skyrocketing?
Well, one of the things that happened is that in the late 1990s, we decided that managed care was not really the thing that we wanted as a society. I guess the labor market was booming. People were doing very well. They didn't like the restraints on which doctors they could see. People were getting very fed up with the limitations of utilization review. Doctors were really annoyed. And what we've seen since that time has been a series of hospital mergers, increased negotiating clout by physicians, and the dissolution of these tightly managed healthcare networks that were really fairly successful in containing costs by negotiating with providers. I think Art is right. The way to get costs down is through using consumer power, and we were very effective in doing that in the provider market in the 1990s. We were not tremendously effective in doing it in the drug market, but we've sort of given up even in the provider market, I think, since then.
Art Kaplan, as a bioethicist, one of the things you've been studying over the years is rationing. You know, the ethics of rationing and the economics of rationing. How do you think the American position on rationing has changed in the past decade?
You know, Terry, I don't think it's really changed all that much. I think that what we do is we do allow money to play a key role in allocating resources. So if it's life-saving resources like transplants, you do see that people get priority who have insurance, who are able to pay. If you look at categories of care, again, money seems to be a driver in terms of who has access. So Americans use money as a core rationing scheme. The other thing we're in love with, and this is kind of interesting because I think it's culturally different from most parts of the world, is we like to rescue people. We don't really like to prevent disease, and we're not all that hepped up in general about maintaining people at good levels of functioning who have chronic illness. But if you're at death's door, boy, do we love to get in there and do something about that. So access to the emergency room, almost still an open door policy regardless of ability to pay. Plenty of ICUs. You couldn't have a heart attack in America without getting to a very wonderful acute care facility in 5 minutes. In the middle of nowhere, you can still get that. We like the moral power of rescue. So we're a culture that loves, if you will, pulling the baby out of the well. Capping the wells, not so enthusiastic. Dragging the babies out who fall in, yeah, we like to do that.
Art Kaplan, if you could be like the czar of the medical system and make a couple of reforms to change the pricing system to try to bring down costs, what would you do?
Yeah, I'm thinking if I'm the czar of the medical system, costs are coming down because people are leaving the country at an enormous rate. But I think I'd do a couple of things. First, consumers, you know, despite all the yakking about this, still don't have good information on health care. So if I this happens to me all the time. People call up and say, I've got a friend who needs procedure X or procedure Y. Could you recommend someone? Well, if we're going to have a market-based medical system, then we need to have information on how well does my doctor do with people like me, how well do hospitals perform. And despite all the yammering about this over the years, we still don't have it. We don't have basic consumer information, and we continue to let the healthcare system bamboozle us by saying, oh, trust us. My answer to that is more information about outcomes in the hands of consumers. I think that would lead costs to come down. Put everybody into the system. Get the 40 million in. Stop having everybody run away from them and try to spend money to avoid them. put them all in, you'll help malpractice. You'll be able also to stop delivering care to these people at the emergency room door where it's completely inefficient and expensive. I think I would, if I'm not going to be able to restrict medical advertising as it's now booming, I'd at least put some tough strictures on it in terms of content and say, you better be focused on information and education, not hyping things all day long. So I'd like to see more Federal Trade Commission oversight of what's going over the airwaves. And I guess the other step I take to really try and drive prices down is build purchasing power into those small businesses. Let them form collectives, give them opportunities to work together to buy cheaper health care. I think small business and part-time employees, we've got to find mechanisms to get them purchasing power again. So those are some steps.
Sherry Gleed, if there was any one or two things that you could do to change the cost structure of the medical system and the health insurance system, what would you do?
Picking up off Art's point is, not only do we need information about the quality of care that doctors and hospitals deliver, but now that we've moved to away from these tightly negotiated managed care plans, we also need information about the prices that they charge. I think one of the absurdities of our healthcare system is it's really impossible to know what it's going to cost to have any sort of procedure or care provided to you. Even if you go out of network in your health plan, you won't know until you get the bill what it actually cost. And that makes it impossible to even think about comparing costs or to use consumer power. So I think that's one element of it. But I think the other thing to realize is that the cost of the healthcare system is not going to come down. As technology keeps improving, we're going to be wanting to buy more and more healthcare, and that's a perfectly reasonable thing for our society to want to do. What we need to be worrying about is not trying to bring the cost of healthcare down, because I think that's ultimately unattainable, but making sure that for individual people who can't afford it, we get healthcare to them.
You know, that's a very important point, and I think it's something I want to underline in terms of ethics power. I don't believe that the American people are angry that they spend too much on health care. If there was a pill that said it costs you each $100,000, but it'll maintain you in a healthy state for 10 years and you'll be vigorous if you swallow this today at age 50, I think people would say, gosh, I'd love to spend $100,000 to get that pill. They don't think they get their money's worth. They know there's waste. They know there's inefficiency. They know that the system seems to be charging them inconsistently for services all over the place. They even know that if they go from hospital to hospital in roughly the same part of the country, they're going to find prices all over the place. They're going to find people recommending different things all over the place. So what we need to do is make sure that we are convinced that we get our money's worth. If we think we get our money's worth, then morally we'll spend it. If we think people are just ripping us off and profiteering off of our interest in having health care, then I think this escalating cost just becomes a kind of club that we use to beat each other over the heads about in terms of where we could save money in society.
Well, I want to thank you both very much for talking with us.
My pleasure.
Thank you, Terry.
Art Kaplan chairs the Medical Ethics Department at the University of Pennsylvania. Sherry Gleed chairs the Department of Health Policy and Management at Columbia University's School of Public Health.